Hello from Midori House in London and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up today with budgets shrinking and audiences looking to their screens rather than at the stage, we hear from a group fighting to keep live performance as the beating heart of the arts world. Also ahead, piping aboard the story of one of the most famous ships in British history.
It was not only a fighting ship, but it was a home and a workplace and eventually a tomb for these 500 men were on board, out of which we've got remains of 179.
Plus, with much of today's politics leaving us speechless, we turn to the political cartoon to get some sense.
I mean, there is nowhere else in the world, even today, which can challenge Britain in the quality and the depth of work we see in our daily newspapers.
All that plus the weekend papers, and we ask the all-important question, where really is the best place to drink wine? That's all ahead this hour, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. And we begin today's programme with a question. Do you have a theatre where you live? Well, as a result, if you do, your local town's economy is more likely to be growing. A link's been made between the overall well-being and success of a place and the existence of a theatre. So why are campaigners still having to fight so hard to keep them open? Well, this year's annual Theatres at Risk list has just been published and the number, as ever, is growing. Claire Appleby is the Architectural Advisor for the Theatres Trust and she joins me in the studio to discuss this. And I'm also joined in the studio by Owen Calvert-Lyons, who's Head of Theatre and Artist Development at Oval House here in London. Oval House is moving to Brixton. There's a current space is being knocked down. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
Hello.
Claire, let's begin with you. What is a theatre at risk?
A theatre at risk is a building which is most under threat, and the threat can be either to the building fabric or it can be due to operational threat as well. So the Theatres at Risk list doesn't only contain those buildings which are disused and vacant and in a serious state of disrepair, but also those which are open and at operational risk, or those which are hosting live performance or have some pop-up events but have a long way to go before capital works funding is raised so that they can complete their project.
It is a difficult issue to keep a theatre open because they are big spaces and they cost an awful lot of money, and a lot of the theatres that we go into nowadays are old and falling apart. I think a couple of years ago in the West End, part of the roof started to fall on the audience during a very, very high-profile play. So yeah, it can happen to the best of them. But this is the issue, isn't it? It is keeping these things running.
But what we always talk about with theatres is in terms of viability. So for us, it's really, really important that the theatres that we're looking at on our Theatres at Risk list have a viable reuse as a theatre, or they're viable to be retained as theatre or live performance use for their communities. So when we are looking at these buildings, one of our first stages of advice is to get a viability study looked at, which will then look at the building, it will look at its historic significance, and find the best use for that building. And when we're talking about theatres, we're talking about flexibility. We're not just talking about going for necessary just for drama, but you're also talking about the front of house spaces, the bars, the cafes. You're talking about going using that space for a music venue or using it for stand-up comedy. You're talking about local groups going in as well, so educational workshops, work with young people. So it's about flexibility of space as well to enable those buildings to have this real viable and sustainable future.
And Owen, Oval House, when you look at the descriptions that are given to it, brave, new, young, a massively dynamic part of the community, but it's going from its current location. Why is that?
Well, it's a very old building, so it actually goes back to the 1930s. It was never built as a theatre. It was actually built as a sort of community centre. Part of it was a gym, which is now our main house. So it's not really fit for purpose. It has all sorts of problems. Claire and I were just discussing that we have rehearsal rooms with glass roofs, which is terrible for keeping them warm. So it's time for it to go. It's also not entirely wheelchair accessible, which is a huge problem for us. Limits both our audiences and the artists we can work with. So it feels like it's time for a change. It has been for some time. And now we've got the opportunity to build a brand new £15 million building in Brixton to solve all of that.
How easy is it to fund something on that scale?
Very difficult. So we are very lucky that Oval House has been going for so long, in that we own that land, and it's a a prime piece of land in
central
London.
Goodness me, you'll get a few luxury flats out of that in London, won't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's a really valuable piece of land, and we can put all of that towards the cost of the new building. We're being really well supported by Arts Council England, who have put a capital grant towards it. But we've still got a fundraising target, so we still need to raise a couple of million pounds over the next couple of years to be able to build that. But we're very lucky to have that at our disposal and to be able to be in a position to build a new theatre in 2020.
Claire, that's the story of progress and movement, and you know, it looks as if, fingers crossed, you should be all right if you get a little bit of fundraising and you get a nice price for your land. And also you have Arts Council, but not all theatres can consider themselves as fortunate as that, are they? Because the theatres that seem to be at risk are either the ones that are in the margins of the big cities, there's one in Hume in Manchester, for example.
Yeah.
Or they are in towns which are seasonal or are not renowned for having a big cultural life there.
Yes, you're right. There are a lot up, particularly in the northwest and in our coastal communities as well. However, that's not to say there aren't ways of bringing these buildings back to life. So up in Morecambe, the Morecambe Winter Gardens is a building that was saved by their friends group there. It was a building saved by the community and is run by a volunteer group at the moment. And it's been operational for several years now. But they still need a lot of work doing to that building so that they can fully restore and fully reopen it. But in the meantime, they are putting on these pop-up events. They are using the main auditorium and hosting shows. They also are used as well for locational filming. So they had an Agatha Christie film there a couple of seasons ago. And that income and that money, that keeps them going, keeps them ticking over. And then it starts raising awareness, and that starts proving the viability of the building as well. So it has some way to go, but, you know, it's on course and it will get there.
I must ask you, though, I don't think I can ever remember a time when the arts have not been clamouring for extra funding and when things have been cut. Why is now particularly different from what we've seen in the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years?
I think there's several reasons. In terms of capital works funding, there was a bigger pot of Heritage Lottery funding around, and those pots are diminishing. So it is becoming more difficult for capital projects. So those big building works projects are much, much more difficult to achieve. But people are also becoming a bit more canny with how they fundraise and how they get together. So we're seeing a lot more crowdfunding. We're also seeing projects which are phased. So they'll take place and you'll get gradual reopening of a theatre as well. Loan funding is also coming into it. But I also think, and I'm sure Evan will back me up in this, it's also to do with the amounts of arts funding in terms of operation as well, which is falling. And you have to be a bit more canny and a bit more shrewd. And that goes back to this idea about flexibility of space and just making sure that there are these other uses. So your bars and your cafes and areas where you can get the local community to come in and support you and to spend.
How much would you agree with the fact that you have to bend and twist yourself into a load of different shapes in order to keep going?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's definitely less funding around, as you've described. A big part of that is the huge cuts to local authority funding. I think that's been a bit hidden by the fact that Arts Council England's money has been at standstill, which I think is giving everybody less money, but disguises the fact that actually the biggest cuts have come through cuts to local authority and huge withdrawal of funding across the country there, and that's been enormously damaging. And that's been core arts money that particularly venues have relied upon. So I think we're going to see more of those cuts. So I think that's been really damaging.
What benefits does something like Oval House actually bring to a community, though? I mean, I've seen you've written in the past or asked the question, what is the civic role of a theatre? Should it just be somewhere where you can present plays? There's much more to offer nowadays.
Absolutely.
You must have more to offer.
Yeah, I mean, for me, a theatre is right at the heart of its community, and all the theatres I've worked for have really believed in that and have worked really hard to make sure that they are central and they're playing a role that goes well beyond just the presentation of art. So if you look at some of the things we're doing at Oval House at the moment, things like becoming a J9 venue, which allows women to report instances of domestic violence to our staff. So that's connected to a production, to creating a production called Smack That, that's all about domestic violence. But it also means that it demonstrates that our team believe that the things that we put on the stage are things that we want to explore, which are all of the challenges that face our communities, that the theatre has an ability to support and develop and change its community beyond just inspiring people through performance.
How much, Claire, does this actually sometimes become a problem of the way that the theatre itself is managed? I mean, listening to the way that Oval House is directed rather elegantly there by Owen, you're doing things which are relevant to the local community, something which examine London life and which offer back something to the community. But can you often find that a couple of productions of The Importance of Being Earnest and a dodgy panto do not make a theatre and certainly do not help a community?
I'm sure you're right. And, you know, Owen has said about how much work that Oval House do with the community. And I think that's really important about making sure that your business and your operation does fit with your community. But I think we also need to look at theatres in a slightly different light as well. And that's what the kind of the potentials and the benefits that they can offer the local economy. And it's something you touched on at the very beginning. So we kind of also call on councils to support their theatres by looking at what they can bring to that local economy through additional footfall on the high street. People want to live in vibrant places. They want to live somewhere where they can go out in the evening, something that supports that nighttime economy. And so we've found that many councils are carrying out economic impact studies now. So up in Waltham Forest, they carried out one recently for the Waltham Stay Granada. And that's estimated that a restored and reopened Granada will bring back between £34 and £52 million over a 10-year period to their local economy, which is substantial. So I think it's about looking at those potentials and opportunities that our theatres offer us.
Do we have those opportunities often overlooked, Owen, that when you look at London theatre, for example, it appears that there is an enormous, obscene dollop of money that is put into the West End every single year. And you see that it is a glorious machine that is expensive to go to, but the quality is amazing. And yet you have the smaller theatres like yourselves who provide an equally important role. But do you ever feel, because you're not an enormous theatre in the West End, that you sometimes feel a bit marginalised?
That can be the case, but generally I think London has a really healthy theatre ecology. We've got to remember that we pay tax on all ticket prices, so there's VAT on all of those. So there's 20% of every ticket that anybody buys goes to the government in tax. So those really expensive tickets that you're talking about in the West End, that generates an enormous amount of tax. And then some of that goes through to the Arts Council, which is then paid back to those subsidised theatres like Oval House. So to an extent, it can feel like those big players are sort of hoovering up a lot of the money that's out there, but they're also generating a lot of money back in.
Are we alone in the way that we manage our theatres here in the United Kingdom, or are there other countries who do it slightly better than we do?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I think we deal with things in a slightly different way. There's a little bit more emphasis on the kind of the theatre operators themselves to generate the cash. We don't get as much subsidy as some of the theatres on the continent. But, you know, then that also gives us a greater opportunity potentially for creativity as well and putting on the programmes we want to.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got quite a healthy balance in the UK. If you look at a lot of European countries, they have a lot more subsidy from the state, which is great. But then you look at the states where it's the other model and it's all from business. And both of those have their own challenges. So,
and what about education? I know that there's been an enormous amount of criticism in the last couple of years for the approach that the government has taken in terms of not prioritising arts education. Are you now feeling it or seeing it in your daily lives?
I mean, for me, that's one of the biggest dangers for the arts in the coming years, is the damage that we're seeing done in terms of the arts being taken out of the education system and it being removed from learning, particularly at that sort of GCSE or baccalaureate level. That we won't see the impact of that for probably another 5 or 10 years. But if children don't believe that the arts is valuable and they're not brought up enjoying the arts, then that will have an impact when they're adults. They won't be going and spending money at theatres, and there'll be less income and less theatres will survive. So for us, it feels really crucial, and the education part of our work is enormous, about ensuring that theatre is core to children's lives.
I wonder whether this is a new use for theatres, to provide a theatre studies GCSE on a Saturday when no one else is.
It could quite well be. I mean, as Owen's saying, there are so many theatres now that are offering those educational workshops and going out into their community, going out and working with their schools. And it's a really increasingly important part of their work.
Claire Appleby, thank you very much indeed for joining me in the studio. And thank you too to Owen Calvert-Jones. You're listening to Monocle 24. Up next on Sunday Brunch, we discuss one of the United Kingdom's most famous warships. Stay with us.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat wiped? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch with me, Emma Nelson. If you've just joined us, a very warm welcome to your weekend. Let's hear now about one of the most famous ships in British history. The Mary Rose was feared by all until it sank in the Solent in 1545. 400 years later, it was salvaged and raised from the seabed by the Mary Rose Trust. Well, Alexandra Hildred is head of research at the Mary Rose Trust, and she joined Monocle's Georgina Godwin to talk about the ship's story.
The Mary Rose was one of the first ships that was requisitioned when Henry VIII came to the throne in 1509. So we have the first letter of requisition, 1510. And Henry VIII is actually known to be the sort of father of the modern navy, in that he actually created all the naval administrations that enabled the vessels, which he inherited four. And by the time he died in 1547, 2 years after the Mary Rose sank, he'd got a fleet of 53 vessels that included 20 huge warships, and completely changed warfare at sea in the 16th century due to all of the things that happened during that time and the wars with France and the skirmishes with Scotland.
Made Britain the great seafaring nation it once was.
Well, certainly he began all of the establishments that are necessary to do that. And one of the first things he did was to mothball the ships between wars so that he was keeping them in reserve rather than all the time having to just go and requisition things from private companies, etc., if war came along. So that is one of the main things. And also the infrastructure, the dockyards, etc. He's responsible for a lot of those.
So tell us about the ship herself.
All right, well, what we know about her, we've got one picture of her, and that's an illustration from an inventory of all of his ships, and you've got actually a painting of it, and then a list of all the weapons, which is really impressive. And when you look at it for all 53 vessels, it's just huge. And he could roll these 12-foot sheets out in front of people and say, look, this is my war fleet, and these are the guns within it. So Mary Rose basically started as, in that time, with very few big guns, quite a few small ones. So it was an anti-personnel, but basically a troop carrier, so that he could have his wars with France and take his troops to France and engage in basically a land battle. The whole period is one of transition of both gunpowder and weapons at sea, etc. And by the time the Mary Rose sank in 1545, with a number of different upgrades, she got 14 large guns on her main gun deck and was capable of a standoff battle, if you like. So that all happened during that period. So it's really exciting because we've got everything from medieval longbows. We've got the only collection of basically the sort of longbows that were used in Agincourt, etc., on the Mary Rose. And we've recovered 173 of the 250 listed. But then you've got the most up-to-date modern bronze guns that Henry requisitioned gun founders from the continent, because they were the best ones in the world, to come and set them up in foundries in London, in fact, not very far from here, Salisbury Place and Houndsditch.
That's quite extraordinary. And this ship has, I suppose, over the years gained near mythical proportions. Why is it so important to our history?
Well, I think it's the period where you're doing this change from medieval to modern, but it's also Henry VIII, you know, and he took an interest in the ship. He paid for it out of his pocket money, if you like, as a young lad, and he followed it throughout its life, and he was actually witness to the Mary Rose sinking on July 19, 1545, where we were facing a French invasion larger than the Spanish Armada. Nobody ever hears about it, but in Portsmouth, the king had brought all of his land forces down, so there were 30,000 encamped on Southsea Common by one of his newest shore forts, and he actually watched as a French fleet came round the Isle of Wight, anchored at St. Helens, and then began skirmishing with their small war galleys that weren't reliant on wind and could come and take a pop at the British fleet, who were all gathered outside Portsmouth Harbour defending the town of Portsmouth from a French invasion. So it's very much involved with him. And of course, that time in history, everybody's exceedingly interested in it. It's very important for Britain because we were beginning to establish ourselves overseas.
Mm. So the ship sunk in this battle, and that, for the moment, was that. She was beneath the waves and gone.
She was beneath the waves, but she was within view of Southsea Common, and so it's about a mile and a half between Southsea and Ryde on the Isle of Wight. We could actually sit on the diving support vessel and see Ryde Spire Church and things. But she wasn't forgotten. She was such an important ship that actually attempts to salvage her in the Tudor times happened. So for 6 weeks, there are reports to the king back and forth saying that they got some Italian, the best salvers, ship salvers were Italians, and got them to come and dive on the ship to try and put strops underneath it to try and put it upright, because she was quite shallow. It's only 12 metres of water. So the ship is 12 metres wide and about 40 metres long. So she'd gone down on her starboard side, as we found out later. We didn't know which side it was, obviously, to begin with. And you could have almost walked at that depth, because she's 12 metres wide. The depth of seawater is between 12 and 14 metres, depending on the tide. So it wouldn't have been that huge a salvage attempt, but for whatever reason, it didn't work. And the last reasons given is that they'd broken the foremast. So what they were trying to do is put ropes on all of the foremasts of the Mary Rose and pull her upright, and then have boats on either side and put ropes underneath. And then as the tide raised, you tighten the ropes and the Mary Rose would magically come to the surface and then be towed in. But that failed because they'd lost this point of purchase on the ship, or had they broken it? You know, these are all questions that we still have as archaeologists, because we've never recovered the complete bow castle. It is broken, but we don't know when.
Now, there was another attempt in 1836.
The attempts between 1836 and 1840 were more to recover objects than to recover the ship, because they knew that this ship had basically disappeared. And that was fortuitous, because the divers concerned had been engaged in basically destroying a ship that had sunk, the Royal George, blocking the channel into Portsmouth Harbour. And so they were using explosives to do that. And some fishermen said, "We keep snagging our nets on this gun." And lo and behold, they went and looked at it, and the first thing they found was a bronze gun with the date 1542 on it. So, you know, luck has a wow. huge part in the Mary Rose story, as does perseverance and endeavour and all sorts of other things.
So the Mary Rose Trust is set up to do what? To preserve what? Because what exists?
Well, an awful lot exists. We've got three quarters of the starboard side of the Mary Rose, so that's one side. She went down on her starboard side. Port side was above the sediments, and gradually it wore away, and most of it disappeared. We found bits of it recently, but only small portions of it. So it's half a ship, but it was full of, buried by this wonderful Tudor silts, which are like, it's like soft flour when you disturb it, but if you cut it, it's like just softened butter, and it's actually that solid. So it's like the best face cream you can imagine. And so things like leather, like wood, are absolutely beautifully preserved. And so you've got basically half of a ship, like a doll's house version of it, complete with the guns on their carriages at the gun stations, with the gun ports, the windows, if you like, open above them. And it is like the moment she sank. So if one were to go and look at the Mary Rose Museum today, where we've got galleries around the ship is like the heart of it, you can actually look into the ship and see the space. And we've magically put all the objects that were found in that space into galleries opposite. And it is like what we had the chance to see as divers, swimming down the decks, looking at objects like this table with objects in front of it as they were laid out when we found them. And that's the magic that we're trying to do. And that's why the Mary Rose is so important. It's not just the hull. It is a lot to do with Henry VIII and the magic of it. It's also to do with the fact it was an underwater excavation. You know, it's priceless as far as getting people's interest. It's shipwreck, it's archaeology, it's difficult visibility, it's daring do. And then you look at it and it's like being transported back into Tudor life. It's amazing. The objects there you just don't get elsewhere, because they're sort of the everyday things. It was not only a fighting ship, but it was a home and a workplace, and eventually a tomb for these 500 men were on board, out of which we've got remains of 179.
Did most of them go down with the ship?
There are a few eyewitness accounts, and they suggest 35 were saved. And if we've got half a ship and we've got 179, then that's sort of probably quite sensible.
So people can come and see this.
People can come and see it in the historic dockyard in Portsmouth. Yes, it's the centrepiece of this marvelous museum with 19,000. We've got 19,000 objects recovered from the site, and we display them both opposite the ship as they were found, so you can sort of have the experience of looking down the main gun or all of the decks, because she had five decks, and we've got pathways on three of them, and then around the outside of it, we explore things like carpentry on board, or surgery on board, or daily life. And we have reconstructed the facial reconstructions of eight individuals and identified their potential jobs by what they were found with. So you can look at the objects found in the carpenter's cabin and then read about the carpenter and his personal possessions. So we're trying to make it personal, because it is all about the people and Tudor life and that day that their lives stopped and our story really began.
Alexandra Hildred there, and you can see the ship for yourself by visiting the Mary Rose Museum in Portsmouth. And from March the 18th, they have the Many Faces of Tudor England, which uses the latest scientific research to show us who the men of the Mary Rose really were. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Let's move now on Monocle 24 to an art form which is staging a huge comeback, the political cartoon. With most of us unable to articulate our true reaction to the current world and politics, the cartoonist plays a vital role in summing up a mainly wordless response. Well, Tim Benson has made a career out of poking fun at Britain's political landscapes, as well as being named the leading authority on the art form. And as part of Sunday Brunch's regular weekend reads, he spoke to Georgina Godwin, speaking about his latest book, Britain's Best Political Cartoons of 2018.
We have had the best political cartoonists here in Britain for hundreds of years, which is incredible. I mean, there is nowhere else in the world, even today, which can challenge Britain in the quality and the depth of work we see in our daily newspapers. Mm. I think a lot of that is to do with the creative freedoms that cartoonists are given in Britain.
I wonder if I could ask you a really basic question, because the word cartoon would seem to me a bit of a misnomer, because they're not funny ha-ha. And I wonder if you could explain the science, if you like, behind
yes.
a cartoon.
Yes, well, the word cartoon is actually a dreadful term, as you just said. Mm. It means so many different things to so many people. And it derives from the Italian word cartone, meaning paper. The first cartoons were, in fact, preliminary sketches. My gallery is called the Political Cartoon Gallery. Well, all the cartoons in it aren't political. But if you call it the Cartoon Gallery, then people think you're talking
or it's
animation
yeah.
or it's comic.
Mm. Mm.
And basically it's newspaper cartoons.
So what is it that a cartoon sets out to do, and how does it do it?
I don't think there's one straight answer, because everyone has different approaches. I mean, generally, they are visual metaphors. They are political comment. Talking about different categories of cartoons, I've gone into difficulties with pocket cartoonists who think that they feel excluded because I don't put them in the book. They do the little pocket cartoons, usually on the front of a newspaper, probably the most famous being Matt in The Telegraph. And a lot of people mistake him for being a political cartoonist. In fact, I met a former cabinet minister a couple of days ago, and when I get these chances to meet these people, I always ask them who their favourite political cartoonist is, and he said it was Matt. And I said, Matt is a pocket cartoonist. He does topical gags, right? So these are, he finds humour in something that has happened in the news. He is not making political comment. And he thought again about it, and then he just said, oh, I'm going to stick with Matt.
That's so interesting. So there is a definite difference, and this is a genre completely on its own.
Indeed. I mean, the pocket cartoon is obviously much smaller, and it's all usually in the caption. The joke is usually in the caption, whereas in the political cartoon, it's on a much bigger scale, and it's usually all in the drawing. It's visual, although sometimes there is a crossover. There's the likes of Mac in the Daily Mail, and he does sort of big format topical gags. So there are grey areas, obviously.
Yeah. You must have, in your time, first with your PhD, then running your gallery, and then editing various books to do with political cartoons, seen the landscape change utterly.
Actually, no. In other countries, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the United States, in the 1980s, there were 300 staff cartoonists. Now there are barely 20. I mean, the newspaper industry has been decimated, again, probably by technology and the internet. Whereas here, apart, sadly, from The Independent, which can only now be seen online, political cartoons get as much exposure as they always did.
Although you say in your introduction to this wonderful book, Britain's Best Political Cartoons 2018, that the space is becoming increasingly squeezed.
It is, because of social media, because of the internet, because of tablets. Young people aren't out there buying newspapers. They're finding everything they need to know from the internet. And as we can see, newspaper circulations are shrinking daily. So it seems inevitable. And of course, the problem is one can never really predict the future. But it does look like newspapers will all end up online, and that causes big problems for the political cartoon for two reasons. One, in the newspaper, it has its set position in the paper on a certain page, and people come across it. They can't avoid it. They'll look at it. They'll enjoy it. They'll savour it for a few seconds, and then they'll move on. Whereas online, sometimes you have to search out the cartoon. And on some of the newspaper websites, it can take a long time to find the cartoon. And obviously, the majority of people won't bother to search for it. And will forget it's there.
And you make the point, too, that the way people are producing cartoons is changing. So where once they were all done, absolutely drawn in real life, if you like, now some of it is actually produced digitally.
That's right. And I must profess, before we go on any further, that I have a vested interest here, as I have a cartoon gallery selling original artworks. And there's not much market for PDFs. Mm. But that's very true. But luckily in this country, the majority of cartoonists still work with pen on paper and watercolour. There is a kind of halfway house where a fair number of cartoonists will do an outline in pen and ink and then will scan it and digitally colour it in. And there are two cartoonists who do it all digitally. But I think it's to the detriment of their draftsmanship. If you look what's happened in the United States, the vast majority of cartoonists now just work on tablets. The draftsmanship has suffered as a result.
You illustrate the whole idea of people reading increasingly online by reproducing this cartoon by Catherine Lamb. And she has three recycling bins, plastic, glass, both of those empty and closed, and then one overflowing, articles on paperless society.
Indeed, yes. And then the other thing, of course, is once newspapers are all online, there won't be the income streams coming in to pay the very best cartoonists. And people with real talent will find other avenues for their talent. If you look at gag cartoons, gag cartoonists 50 years ago could earn a fantastic living. And we had some great household names, people like Bill Tidy and Larry and McGlashlin and numerous others. But all the magazines, all the outlets for gag cartoons have gone. So now gag cartooning has kind of disappeared. You know, you still see it in the oldie and Private Eye, but you can't earn a great living from it. So people with real talent have gone elsewhere.
But new streams are coming on. So, for instance, animated satire.
Yes, I must say, do you ever see Morton Moorland's animated cartoons on the Times website? I mean, they're absolutely fabulous. But generally, I prefer the static cartoon to the animated one. Obviously, it's more commercially viable to do a static one. The animation takes a lot of time and therefore money to produce. And you've still got to have a punchline. So it's kind of, you know, the point that is made in a static cartoon. This is a great thing. It has some sort of immediacy that you look at it and you've got it within a second. You then have to, with an animated cartoon, look at it and wait for the ending. So it kind of does the same thing, but it just takes longer.
So how do you cut them down? How do you choose what makes the cut?
I'm a bit sad. And the fact is, it's never ending because, you know, when one book ends, I then have to start the following years. Sadly, I look at all the cartoons every day, and generally it works out to about 15 a month. So I will make a short list of around 25 and then cut them down, because I try and include every cartoonist that's working in the national press. So make sure everyone has good coverage in the book. And also, what I try to do is pick cartoons that cover a specific news event. Mm. So what we have is a visual history of the year through political cartoons. And of course, we put the context of the cartoon, because the problem with topical cartoons is that they can become dated within days, let alone weeks or years. So we put the context of what is going on in the cartoon so people can still appreciate them in the future. And also, we've got insights by the cartoonists themselves about they decided to do this and the editor said, well, I think you should leave that out because that might cause trouble. And in fact, there's an unpublished cartoon in there which the Guardian refused to publish.
And which one is that?
That's the Steve Bell one on Benjamin Netanyahu's visit. He even revised it and the paper still refused to publish it. I mean, the wonderful thing about cartoons is they're not objective at all. They're completely subjective and they're full of vitriol and spite and bite. But the great thing is we have cartoonists on the left and in the centre and on the right in the book. I think there's a nice balance there. And and political cartoons are unfair. The fact is, cartoonists are always reacting to events. Otherwise, it would be propaganda. If they were supporting a certain line, it would be mere propaganda, as we saw in the Soviet Union, the cartoons that were published there.
Tim Benson there, talking to Georgina Godwin, and Britain's Best Political Cartoons of 2018 is out now. And if you love reading, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next on Sunday Brunch, we go through the weekend papers.
What is it like to be a city forgotten and rediscovered? Monocle Films travels to Gunsan in South Korea to bear witness to its urban revival. Here, natives and newcomers are creating quirky bars, art spaces and a bright future for this charming coastal outpost. Gunsan, building on the past, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
It's 11:38 if you're brunching in Munich, 10:38 here in London. Welcome to Sunday Brunch if you've just joined us. It's Emma Nelson here and I'm looking at the weekend papers. And to help me, I'm joined in the studio by the broadcaster and journalist Juliette Foster. Welcome back, Juliette.
Thank you very much.
You wanted to start off with the Sunday article Telegraph. In the Sunday Telegraph talking about Nicolas Maduro and his future and the fact that he's been holding power. Mainly are saying because the military still wish to keep him there, but there are signs now that that is changing.
Yes, that's correct. This is a piece which basically claims that the reason why the military is keeping him in power is because you've got rank and file members who actually don't like him, but it's the guys at the very top of the food chain, in other words, the top brass. They've been guilty of committing various crimes against the Venezuelan people, so it's in their interest to make sure that Maduro is propped up, because obviously if he falls from grace, so too do they. They're also open to prosecutions. But also as well, these individuals at the top, they control this very powerful security machinery, which has infiltrated all areas of life. So the fear is from some of the rank and file soldiers is that if they do get involved in anti-Maduro activities, okay, even if they manage to defect and go off elsewhere to safety, it's their families and friends who could be punished in return, retribution. So that fear is keeping them there. But they're quoting a couple of sources, so you could argue, well, that's not really a very objective measurement, because these people obviously have an axe to grind, but it does sound fairly plausible. And the whole point about it is that we're now reaching a kind of tipping point with Venezuela, because we know that the Americans have supplied a huge tranche of aid, which is actually being held in warehouses on the border with Colombia. The question is, will the military look the other way and allow this aid to go through to those who need it?
They certainly didn't earlier on this week. I think many of us saw those pictures of the military blocking the main bridge road in from Colombia into Venezuela. But the issue that now is going to be is whether Juan Guaido, the man who has declared himself as interim president, he has promised that the aid will come in next week.
Yes.
Now, that is setting himself up for an absolute showdown, because he will know that the popular feeling at the moment is not political, it is hunger. And for Absolutely. Those who are not being given the subsidies, those who don't live in the slums, who are given the government allowance every single week, which effectively buys their vote with food, there are people who are dying because there isn't any food.
Absolutely, but you do wonder how much longer that buying the vote phenomenon can last, because this article also tells us, for example, that some people earn as little as a few dollars per month, and inflation on course this year is tipped to reach 10%. Now, can you imagine what it's like that if you ever went into a supermarket, you have $50 on you to budget, you buy a few things from the shelves, by the time you get to the cash register to pay for these goods, you haven't got enough money. Yeah? Because 10%, things are accelerating in value, very basic things. We know that the health infrastructure has collapsed in Venezuela. Doctors are unable to uphold their professional oath, the Hippocratic Oath, to treat people, not because they don't want to, but they haven't got the means to do it. People are dying of illnesses, diseases, which are not commonplace, or which shouldn't be commonplace in a developing country. Some more disturbing facts have arisen from this article, because they've quoted an organisation called Transparency International, and they recently released their Corruption Perceptions Index. Venezuela was perceived as one of the most corrupt countries, ranking 168th out of 180. You've also had people quoting the fact that you've got various directors and other hangers-on from the government who arrive in $3,000 suits and with no shame in front of regular officers who couldn't even afford to eat three times a day. So this is a country which is on its knees. The question is, how much further can it sink into the mud?
Let us move on to the Sunday Times. Now, Jeff Bezos, it's not often that we do celebrity, but this is astonishing because this is an issue of blackmail and an issue of a man who had an affair with a woman and took photographs that he possibly shouldn't have done and sent them online, which he probably really shouldn't have done. And then it becomes not just an argument about whether you should blackmail someone over the ownership of certain photographs, but whether this actually becomes a much, much bigger fight between those who support Donald Trump and those who don't.
Yeah, I mean, I found this story absolutely fascinating because Jeff, it's the contradiction. Jeff Bezos, you're absolutely correct. He's been in trouble because of he's actually had more than a skirmish with the people who had those photographs, the National Enquirer. Its parent company is American Media Incorporated, AMI. Now, Jeff Bezos is one of these figures who up until now has attracted criticism because of his business, Amazon, that it's highly mechanized. You've got people who are working a lot of them have said we work under quotas when we're in those warehouses, that basically the more of the orders that we process working with the machines, the more money we get. So you've had labour organisations who've criticised the way that people work, the money they're paid, etc. They see Amazon as an abuser of the so-called gig economy. And now all of a sudden, through his own personal problems, Jeff Bezos is actually being held as a hero because he is standing up to AMI, okay, because they own the National Enquirer. And as you've rightly said, they got hold of these photographs. They basically said to him, according to Mr. Bezos, they were basically saying, look, you own the Washington Post, and we think that a lot of the Trump bashing that goes on of the Washington Post, you can stop it. So here's the deal. Stop the Trump bashing and we won't publish these pictures. And as the paper says here, he took the stand, first exhorted by the Duke of Wellington, okay, all the way back in 1824, before our time. In other words, publish and be damned. And of course, as far as he's concerned, look, I don't like the idea that my private life is going to be splashed out, because one of the photographs has, and I quote, a shirtless Mr. Bezos holding his phone in his right hand while wearing his wedding ring. He's wearing either tight black cargo pants or shorts, and his semi-erect manhood is penetrating the zipper of said garment. Okay, so they're basically saying, if you don't want
I
this published...
I said that, Julia. I was doing really well until we actually talked about what was being
said.
And
you're still doing well. But the whole point about this is that it's Bezos has come out as the hero, because, you know, he's the world's richest man. He's worth over $160 billion. And at the same time, for Southern District prosecutors in New York, this is a nightmare, because the National Enquirer, they were involved in the catch and kill. Okay, now the catch and kill story revolved around Karen McDougal, who was a former Playboy model who said that she'd had this affair with Donald Trump. So, of course, she was going to sell the story, and the National Enquirer got hold of it, gave her some money, and basically killed the story before it could actually go out there and ruin Donald Trump's chances of being elected. So they've pretty much fessed up to this, but they were told in the deal that they cut with the prosecutors, we'll be very good boys and girls for 3 years. They've breached that. Okay. The other problem that's come out of this is that because of the way they've conducted themselves and these allegations of blackmail, other people have come forward and said, well, actually, we were being picked on and threatened with blackmail. And of course, one of those who's coming forward is the investigative reporter Ronan Farrow. Who he? Well, talk to Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein knows all about Ronan Farrow because it was Ronan Farrow who blew the whistle on the bullying accusations, the racism and the sexism, the rape allegations, etc., which have actually sunk Harvey Weinstein's career, even though he's now fighting those.
On a much lighter note, there's a great joke doing the rounds saying, I don't want to be shown, what was it? I don't want Jeff Bezos to give me his penis. I'd rather get a penis from a small local supplier in the high street to get rid of the online suppliers.
And there's also another headline in Mr. Bezos's blog where he wrote about this, or somebody wrote about it. Bezos exposes Pecker. Read into that what you will.
Absolute genius article. I think both the Huffington Post, I can't remember who else it is, put their headline out.
It's great.
It's absolutely great, and there's great stories knocking around the internet.
Makes you wish you'd actually invented it yourself, actually, or written it yourself.
There's an article actually in the New Yorker by the woman who invented it. She was on the subway in New York, and they were all having a kind of a WhatsApp. What headline should we go for?
Bandying around ideas.
I can't say this. Okay, I'm going to say it, and suddenly it seizes the world.
Well, it's like a t-shirt slogan, isn't it? You could just imagine it. Because in the 80s, we had Frankie Says, Bezos exposes Pecker.
I don't wear those kinds of T-shirts, Julia.
Right. Of course not. I can see the angel's wings fluttering on your back. Yes, of course. Let's move on.
What's next? Okay, so Jeff Bezos managed to cause a stir by what he said this week. One man who really, really got people crossed this week, or got them cheering, depending on which side of the Brexit debate, was Donald Tusk, talking about there's a special place in hell reserved for the people who campaigned for Brexit without a clear idea of how they were going to do it safely.
Yes, that's correct. Donald Tusk, if you don't know who he is, well, you ought to. But I mean, just to give you a bit of background, I mean, Donald Tusk is the president of the European Council. He was elected to this position in 2014 by the 28 member states. So in other words, Britain was one of those countries which actually voted for him. So we're talking about the pre-Brexit referendum. But anyway, he made the headlines for either the wrong reasons or the right reasons with that quote. But this little piece in The Observer actually gives you a sense of context, which the cradle, what makes Donald Tusk who he is. It's a really fascinating piece. Now, he was born in the 1950s, about 1957. And when he was 14 years old, so about 1969, You had a rebellion by the Polish people, because remember, in those days, Poland was governed by a communist government. And so it was basically a satellite of the old USSR, the United Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But basically, he was scarred by memories of the army rolling in on their tanks and firing on the protesters. And as the article says here, Tusk was left with the opinion that those who are beaten are often the ones in the right. Now, at one stage, he said that, you know, he's admitted it, that he hung out with undesirable people, football hooligan gangs. So he wasn't a particularly nice person running with the local thugs. But then in 1976, he goes to university in Gdansk. Gdansk is important because Gdansk was the place of the shipyards. Lech Wałęsa was working at the shipyards, and it was Lech Wałęsa who led the Solidarity movement, okay? And it put him on a collision course with the communist rulers, and of course you had General Jaruzelski and the various others. In fact, Jaruzelski was backed by Moscow, and it was Jaruzelski who actually brought in martial law. So you had all these cataclysmic events which Tusk witnessed. At one stage, he worked as a bread seller, then as a labourer, because he was effectively blacklisted for his activism. He was arrested, briefly imprisoned. He was a co-founder of an illegal monthly called The Political Review, and it propagated the idea of liberal democracies. And as they've said in the article, that was going to be the basis of his political shaping rather than his awakening. He was awakened by what he grew up with, and it was solidified, if you like, by those years in exile when he was actually dodging the law, whatever. And
he's a perfect European insofar as I think a lot of people have missed out that one of the great benefits of the European Union was the rights that it affords to people. It's not just an economic union or a trade union, which is what so many of the Brexiteers have been pushing for. It is a union which has promoted equal pay, equal treatment for women, the right to a private life. So many things that underpin a liberal democracy.
Yes, things that we take for granted. But he grew up in an environment where some of those basic rights were denied. They were there if you were at the very top of the food chain. But for the masses who were below that, OK, for the masses below, they didn't have that. So for him, the European project is so very, very personal because he basically lived through a lot of the things which... the crimes, if you like, which were committed and which are coming out to this day. We know about the Stasi files, for example, of the East German police, which have been released, uncovered, and various people who were in their firing line. So for him, the European project is very, very personal. And that was basically why it's the backdrop to why he made those remarks. So you may not like what he said, but it tells us that for him, you have to keep the European project together because you don't want to return to those dark days. And coming from somebody who lived through that period of time, you can understand the passion.
Juliet Foster, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. In a moment, we work out where you should have a glass of wine. Where does one drink one's wine? It's not a question that's often considered, perhaps because the focus is more on what you put into your glass as opposed to where you're drinking it. But there is something to be said, surely, for a glass of the palest rosé being served in Provence or a juicy Valpolicella accompanying dinner in restaurant in Verona. So there's no better guide than Where to Drink Wine, the essential guide to the world's must-visit wineries. The author is Chris Losh, and he spoke a little earlier on to Georgina Godwin.
In one sense, it's a fairly traditional wine book because almost every wine book starts in France. There's a reason for that. It's one of the biggest wine producing countries. It's got every single style that you would want to have in your cellar. And it's just a really good place to go. Whichever region you end up in France, there's going to be wineries that are worth visiting. And some of them are expensive and exclusive and you have to phone ahead and they might not let you in. Other ones are just little guys making it in there. Pretty much in their back garden, and they're delighted to see you. And, you know, you get that all of that in France. And I think one of the interesting things about the book as I was researching it is that you discover that places are becoming more open to tourists. So France in the past, literally, you'd be kind of, if you'd knock on the door and they might let you in or they might not, depending on whether it was lunchtime. Whereas now, a lot more places are open to tourism. They've got websites that you can book tours on. And, you know, they're just happier to see you, I think. And then that makes the job of the wine tourist a lot easier than it would have been 20 years ago, I think.
Because there is a global trend. The whole kind of wine tourism revenue is rising.
It really is. And the interesting thing is that the New World countries, who in one sense would have seen themselves as behind Europe in terms of prestige and history and heritage and culture and so on, are actually in many ways leading the charge on this. I think wineries, even in places like Chile, which is probably not most people's first stop when it comes to wine tourism, they've got amazing stuff on offer, especially if you like horses.
So it's things like horses, those add-ons that make various places stand out.
Yeah, I think that what I was attempting to do with this book was, weirdly, for a wine book, it's not necessarily all about the wine. I was trying to give a variety of visits for people all over the world, depending on what they might fancy doing. So some visits are very wine driven. You know, you can sit down and do a big expensive tasting with the winemaker, perhaps. Other ones are a lot more relaxed and they could have other things on offer which are not really related to the wine. So Francis Ford Coppola has a winery in Sonoma. There's a swimming pool. You know, he's got these giant bocce courts, which is kind of like boule, but Italian version. They've got like big tables where you can go and play chess. And he's got loads of memorabilia from his films there. So you can see Marlon Brando's desk from The Godfather if you want. This is the kind of thing where even if you're only kind of partly interested in wine, you can go and have a really good visit. And, you know, wine will be a bit of the visit, but it's not the only reason that you'd go there. And, you know, I'm trying to kind of, all throughout the book, I'm trying to give this different balance of visits which can appeal to different levels of engagement with wine, if you like.
Now, as well as all the usual places, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Germany, Austria, you also went to Eastern Europe, to the Balkans. And that's not somewhere that springs to mind readily as a winemaking region.
No, I mean, well, interestingly, in terms of winemaking, it has got a fair bit of history, but it's not terribly well known over here. I think it will become better known because I think particularly the younger generation now are looking for places that are a bit different. And, you know, they do have interesting stories. They have interesting grape varieties. And in fact, one of my weirdest visits was to a place in Bosnia-Herzegovina called Manastir Tvrdos, which is, and it's kind of an old Serbian Orthodox monastery. It's basically the whole crop is harvested and made by monks. So you go into the winery and it's full of guys with like massive beards down to their knees and black cassocks on making the wine, which is a bit different.
The UK too is a place that hasn't traditionally been known for its amazing wine culture, but certainly is more and more on the map now.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, one of the biggest trends actually in the wine world at the moment is the growth of UK sparkling wine in particular. And I think in terms of tourism, we're still a little bit behind the curve. You know, it's expensive to put visitor centres and have people on call the whole time to take people around the winery and stuff. But it's definitely starting to happen. I mean, there's a new winery in Sussex called Rathfinney, which is going to be one of the biggest in the UK. And, you know, they've got beautiful old stone barns you can stay in. I think this year they've brought in proper visitor centre and all this kind of stuff. So they're up there with that. And Chapel Down, who are a big producer, they've got some really interesting facilities you can go and wander around, and a shop that you can buy loads of stuff in and stuff your face with food. And you can even, if you want, you can kind of adopt a vine. I'm not sure that vines need a great deal of love and attention, but what that does mean is that you can go there and sort of visit your vine during the year and get to take part in the harvest in a small way. You can come do a bit of picking and stuff in the autumn, which is quite a nice touch. And I think we'll probably see a bit more of that as there's lots of people in the UK who are interested in wine, and now they actually have the chance to drive to a vineyard that's probably, you know, not more than, you know, an hour or two from their door and engage with the guys. Don't even have to go abroad, which is fantastic.
What's your favourite?
My favourite region, initially I narrowed it down to five places, which probably isn't very helpful. I think what I'd say is, look, for someone who's never been on a wine holiday before, I would say either California or South Africa are the best, because they're really well set up for kind of touring, and you don't always have to book ahead, and they've got good restaurants, you can roll up and they're good. For me personally, I think my favourite region is probably the Douro, which is northern Portugal. It's where the port comes from, and it is absolutely magnificent. And you can fly into Porto, which is where all the port lodges are, and you know, in the evening you can sit on the quayside and eat cheap food and drink wine and look at all the kind of big signs lit up against the night sky, and it's absolutely spectacular. Then during the day you can either get this little rattly train which goes down the river all the way up towards the Spanish border, and for most of that journey it's literally 5 meters from the River Douro, which is wide, broad, spectacular. On both sides you have steep terraced vineyards with little whitewashed buildings, and the names of the port houses written in black paint on the white walls, and it's the most incredible place.
I bet it is, Chris Losh. Where to Drink Wine, the essential guide to the world's must-visit wineries, is out now. That's all we have time for today's edition of Sunday Brunch. Thanks to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, and our researcher, Mariana Lagrasta. Coming up, Sue Georges on the Midori House Sessions, and then from midday, we have the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening, and have a good weekend.